Today's program was brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to the food scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Here, a very enthusiastic Aaron Sanchez. Can you roll those R's for me? I just can't do it.
Aaron. Okay, if I can, I can roll my R's, but I can flutter my L's. Paladar.
Oh, we'll get to paladar because it's one of those be still my heart kind of places. Yeah. I mean, for those of you that do not know Aaron, you know, he is a Mexican, and I stress on the C-A-N there. You grew up on the border town of, you know, the U.S. and Mexico. Tell me what that was like.
Well, it's the idea of having one foot in one culture and another foot in another, and having that sort of relate to your upbringing is very impactful because it really defines who I am. I have a lot of roots still in El Paso, Texas, and the dichotomy of seeing Mexico every day when you're driving or you're going with your dad or your folks or whatever, and see Mexico right in front of you, it really changes your perspective and makes you feel more connected to where you're from and your culture, and also appreciative of where you are.
You have the Rio Grande flowing, but I mean, was that an easy border to traverse? Was it more affable to having people go back and forth?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was your reality growing up, honestly. Every sort of middle class Mexican American on the El Paso side had a housekeeper or a babysitter that would come over from Juarez in the morning, work with you in their house, and then in the afternoon go across the border. And that happens every day, and probably still does. But now, you know, those days were a little more porous, the border. Now they're a little bit more regulated, sadly. But it's funny because Juarez is considered one of the more dangerous cities in the world, and El Paso is one of the top three safest cities in America. So you can imagine, you know, that as well.
Yeah, I mean, aside from people going back and forth, a lot of cultures were transported in through El Paso. Obviously, you know, Mexican cuisine. What was different about that kind of Mexican cuisine? Because I know it's so regional.
Yeah, it is. I mean, there's 32 states in Mexico with the Distrito Federal, you know, and everyone, it's not like no other, it's like any other culinary superpower, Italy or Spain. It's very regional. You cook what's iconic in those particular places and what's available. And the north, the food of the north is very much based in green chili, milder chili. So they make, you know, chile colorado, and they make green chile. They make flour tortillas. They have machaca. A lot of these dishes that are burritos, like the true northern carne asada burritos, or those are really sort of inherent to where I'm from in the north, in Chihuahua and Sonora, in that area.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that area was steeped in culture, but so was your family. I mean, your mother Zarela, for those that don't know, explain, you know, her as a person, but also her effect on New York, if not the nation, with Mexican cuisine.
It's true, Michael. You know, if you think about the impact my mom had at a time when American regional cuisine was being really founded. So you have people like Alice Waters and Paul Prudhomme and Larry Forgione, my mother, Jonathan Waxman. These people were instrumental in showing America that each particular part of this country has something to offer, and it's unique. And my mom basically took a cooking class with Paul Prudhomme in 1981. He called Warner Leroy, who was the proprietor of Tavern on the Green, which was the most profitable and successful restaurant in the United States for 20 years, came up, cooked a dinner with Chef Paul Prudhomme, Alice Waters, and my mother cooked in 1982, and that's how she was sort of introduced to the food scene and all the big players. So James Beard was there, Joe Baum, all the people that really were the mover and shakers. And my mom brought us along. So it was me and my twin brother, and that's how we got started.
Yeah, I mean, you started cooking with your mother, doing catering company stuff back in El Paso. And, you know, at in 84, two years after that Tavern on the Green dinner, you moved to New York as well.
Yes. And so she came up initially to do the dinner, and then, you know, she kind of got smitten with the city like so many people did. And then we went back to El Paso. She loaded all of our possessions in a catering van, and then we basically moved and drove behind a bunch of truckers from El Paso to New York with $2,000 to our name. And that's sort of how the story began. And it really was instrumental in showing me the value of sacrifice and hard work and all the things that are important.
Yeah. Did you work at Cafe Marimba?
I did. That was my mom's first restaurant. She was executive chef. She was not an owner. She actually worked for a gentleman named David Kay. And David Kay was a huge restaurateur in the 80s in New York. He had Auntie Wong's, he had Pig Heaven, Safari Grill, which was on top of Cafe Marimba on 65th and 3rd. And across the street from that was Sign of the Dove, which was one of the most sort of iconic restaurants in New York for a long time. So my mom was part of that really sort of renaissance in New York dining scene at that time.
I mean, aside from your mother's cooking, was there a lot of other Mexican food in New York?
No, it's funny. My mom tells a story about the Folders guy.
Mm-hmm.
They said, like in 1984, the Mexican food in New York has the same resemblance to a howling monkey has to man. That's how bad it was.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It was pretty out there.
Yeah. I mean, did you feel spoiled or did you feel different? I mean, yeah. I've been to your mother's house and had a rose con crema.
Of course. And my mom adores you, by the way. Yeah, it's funny. I felt privileged in a lot of ways, and at the same time, I was sort of disappointed that a city as big and as grandiose as New York didn't have good Mexican food. I found it, you know, unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, is that what you wanted to cook? Because it's such a funny twist of fate that at the age of 16, you too took a master class with Paul Prudhomme.
Yeah. Well, it took me a long time. My mom did a really good job in telling me I didn't know anything, and you know, at 40 years old, she still tells me I don't know anything. But that's neither here or there. But she actually, I didn't feel comfortable cooking Mexican food. I just didn't. I felt like I didn't know enough. I wasn't well enough studied. I wasn't traveled enough. So I really sort of put that on the back burner and wanted to learn about other cuisines. And that initially brought on my trip to New Orleans, because I lost my father when I was 13. And like any other teenager, I reacted poorly just to being a teenager, and then you compile that with losing your dad. So I kind of was just really undisciplined and gave my mom a lot of grief. So, you know, she said, I can't handle this fucking kid. Like, Paul, take this guy for me, you know? So he's like, I'll get him right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll get him right. Send him down here and I'll show him 100 pounds of Louisiana shrimp and he's going to be peeling.
Yeah.
And we'll get that little nastiness out of him.
Yeah, so I mean, I know now you're very good friends and business partners with John Besh.
Mm-hmm.
New Orleans was there for you at a young age, and you're also a Saint fan, right?
Yep,
yeah,
absolutely.
That. Is that what they
say? Excuse me, Michael, say it with the reverence that it deserves. Who dat?
Who dat? Well, I'm not an NFL fan. I'll leave that to you.
I know you play some baseball.
Yeah.
You know, you're part of that Jewish pitching sort of legacy that happened here in New York, and you know, your dad was, and your family were all into baseball.
Shomer Shabbos, Sandy Koufax. I don't do Saturdays. This is about you, sir. This is about you. So, I mean, going down to New Orleans, there's obviously so much tradition down there, too. And you talk about peeling shrimp. Tell me what Cajun and Creole tasted like the first time you had it.
Well, I'll tell you a really interesting story. Like, you know, first of all, Chef Paul never had children. So he took on a lot of his cooks and young, you know, apprentices as his kids. And when I got there, he was very, very clear with me about what the rules were and what we were supposed to do and how we were supposed to act. And so I remember I asked him one time, I said, what's the deal with these magics? You know, he makes these seasonings called, you know, magic, K. Paul's magic. And he said to me, he goes, boy, when I was a boy, chickens used to run around free range before it became cool. Like, the only chickens we got were free range. And he goes, and they would eat things that fell off the trees. They would eat sassafras, and they'd eat bay leaves, and they'd eat thyme. And he goes, so the chicken tasted like something. And he goes, and now that we were mass producing chicken in this sort of way that they're doing it now, he's like, I needed to reintroduce the nature back into the product. So that's why all his seasonings have those elements of nature that he grew up in. So that's how we uplifted it. You know, that's brilliance. That's like such wisdom to think like that.
Then is it weird for you to have spent your time with Paul Prudhomme and then go into a more sterile setting that is Johnson & Wales?
Yeah.
I mean, I know it has an amazing staff and cuisine and curriculum, but, you know, you're learning from some guy who's you know, taking chickens from the street.
Yeah, well, it was actually disheartening in a lot of ways, and not taking any weight from Johnson & Wales, but those were the days before Food Network. Those were the days before this industry was glamorized. And so you really did it as a place where kind of like miscontents and little rebels against authority went. That's what you did. It's like a vote tech school. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. You're going to be a plumber because you're a mess up in school. You know what I mean? So when I got there, I'd already been cooking, and then I'm over there doing brew noir, cutting bell peppers, and you know, and doing, you know, sort of minutia kind of kitchen work. And I was like, you know, this is not cool. I felt like I was being taken back a step.
Yeah. Did you act out again?
I did. Yeah. I only passed one course actually out of six. And then the ironic stuff now is I get calls from people from John Swell say they want to name a wing after me now.
Yeah.
No one gave a shit about me then.
Yeah.
And now it's funny how the tables turn.
Well, is the wing going to be that place where everyone sits before detention?
Yeah, totally. I'm sure we'll have like salsa music playing something. Yeah.
So, you know, what's funny is when you went back into cooking after Johnson & Wales, you worked for Nuevo Latino chefs, Douglas Rodriguez.
Yes.
So did you feel comfortable with your Mexican heritage enough to start exploring that cuisine, or it just was a job?
Well, I'll tell you a funny story about how I got started at Patria, which was the first 3-star Latin restaurant ever given, actually, and which Raisho gave us that review while I was cooking there. I had an interview at Gramercy Tavern when Tom Colicchio was cooking there. And my mom had told me about this place, Patria, on 20th Street off of Park Avenue. And I'm like, so I'm going. And I remember her saying something about how incredible the food was. So then I was walking to Gramercy, and Patria was next door. So I was like, I looked up and I saw this sign. I was like, oh, that's Patria. Let me go in there and ask. Hi, I'm Sarela Martinez's son. I'm looking for some work. Do you have some? Douglas came out. He said, come back here tomorrow. And I never went for my interview at Gramercy. So imagine how my life would have changed had I worked at Gramercy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
What was Nuevo Latino then?
Well, it really started with a chef, and I want all the people, hopefully, that are listening to the show, which is about 10 people. But anyway,
it's big with mothers. Yeah. Your mom, my mom.
Exactly. Yeah. No, the idea, there was a chef named Felipe Lombardi Rojas, and he was like the first Latin chef to come to New York, and he was a chef at a place called the World Room, I think it was called, and he wrote a book called The Art of South American Cooking, and I don't know if you've heard of it, but it was really sort of the Bible for Latin chefs, and he was the first chef in like the 80s to really talk about stuff from Peru and Colombia and Argentina, so he kind of inspired Douglas, and then we kind of took that idea of peasant kind of home style Latin food from all over the Caribbean, Central America, Mexico, and South America, and then just sort of alter that and augment that with contemporary technique and great ingredients. And that's in essence what Nuevo Latino cuisine is.
Yeah. So the word Latino, you yourself, do you feel more Mexican or Latin?
I'll tell you the one thing I don't like is the word Hispanic.
Mm-hmm.
I think the word Hispanic sort of, you talk to scholars who study, you know, Spanish history and antiquity, they'll tell you that when you say you're Hispanic, that you're acknowledging the conquista. You know what I mean? You're acknowledging that you were under, you know, Spanish rule. And a lot of people will disagree with that. I think there's a term, you know, for me, it'd be, I'm Mexican at soul, that's how I think, that's how I act, I speak Spanish with my tío sitting next to me, that's what we do. We have his friend Rogelio here visiting from El Paso. We don't forget our culture, you know, that's what we do. We speak Spanish first, and there's a saying in Spanish that says, cuando pierdes tu lengua, pierdes tu patria. You know, when you lose your tongue, you lose your country. And nowadays, you have like all these Latin people like, yeah, I'm down, what? It's like, no one speaks Spanish. And that's fundamental. So,
I mean, this was obviously a thread through your life too, because from that you seem to go through a lot of different Latin kitchens.
Yeah,
you know, and ones that even blended, you know, Caribbean cuisine and Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. You met a business partner of yours, Alex Garcia, yeah, and opened up a couple of restaurants. Tell me about why Latin cuisine was then such an impetus for moving forwards.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned a guy named Alex Garcia, who I think is people, you know, it's so funny, like, because the, you know, kitchens is very much like music and art. You know, it's like you have these guys that are such talented people that for whatever reason don't get the attention that they deserve. You know, what was it, that musician, Sugarloaf or Sugarman, that movie that just came out?
Oh, yeah, from Detroit.
Yeah, from Detroit. Yeah. And this guy stayed dormant for like 30 years, and you know what I mean? And they resuscitated his career and all this. And Alex is one of those guys. Alex cooks like a Latin grandma. tons of seasoning and just love and you know, and such a good cook. You know what I mean? There's good chefs. I mean, there's great cooks. You know, Douglas is a great cook and a great chef. So is Alex. You know, he'll make a sofrito that will just blow your mind. You know what I mean? A black beans that you're just like, I can't believe that that tastes that good.
Yeah. What was Arizo Latino?
Arizo Latino was a Latin bistro, like, so very much like you would go to a Baltazar or Cafe Felix in Soho. Alex wanted to create a restaurant that was sort of inspired by Patria, but a little bit more easy, you know, easy to understand. He had these beautiful clay plates. It was right on West Broadway between Prince and Spring, and just an amazing restaurant, you know what I mean? And big wooden tables, so ahead of its time. And it was a little kitchen. It was me, Alex, and a garmanger person, and one dishwasher.
Yeah.
And if we called in hungover, we closed the restaurant because there was nobody else to cook.
Yeah.
So it'd be literally me and Alex working in a tiny kitchen. The whole counter was covered with mise en place.
What did you want to cook?
I wanted to cook food that I grew up eating, to be honest. But I felt, it's so funny, now you have kids that are so enamored with molecular gastronomy. I can't even say it. That's how bad I don't like it. And they're enamored with it. And now you see chefs. I was just in Cleveland with Mike Simon, Ken Oringer, Paul Kahn, Mark Vetri, Dean Farring, the people that I respect and I'm privileged to call friends. All we kept talking about the whole weekend was, we're getting back to cooking our grandma's food. That's everything we kept saying. Damn, I wish I can cook like my grandma. You know what I mean? And so we're not enamored with the fancy stuff anymore. It's more about getting back to roots.
Well, we're going to take a quick break and talk about the area where a lot of my Jewish grandmothers grew up in. Lower East Side.
Yeah.
And the amazing and heartfelt place of Paladar.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We'll be right back.
To a better garden? Absolutely. It's the new free app, Homegrown with Bonnie Plants. Note, track, and photograph your garden's progress. Personalize your weather and reminders. Get variety info, grow guides, hands-free dictation, and more. The Homegrown with Bonnie Plants app, the sharpest tool in your garden. Download it free on the App Store.
And welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Aaron Sanchez, or Aaron Sanchez.
And they call you Turkey. Your friends call you Turkey.
Pavel, yeah?
Yeah, or Guajolote.
Yeah, Guajolote.
Is the Indian name for Turkey.
Paladar. I was taken there by my now wife 10, 11 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, oh yeah, no, it's this great little place. Little did I know how big a crush she had on you.
Really, that's not necessary.
Yeah.
you trump me in that apartment.
Yeah.
Come on, man. You're the man.
But what was Paladar was the cutest.
Yeah.
Paladar was the friendliest. And you were there. You were there in the kitchen. You were there behind the counter. That felt like your soul.
Yeah.
Did it feel like that to you?
Yeah. I mean, you talk to any chef and they'll tell you that they have a restaurant that defines them. And it happened really by circumstance. You know, I'd cooked around the city and I wanted to have a place that was affordable. And I remember we took that space in 99, actually, but it took us a while to get open. I remember because it was permits and stuff like that. But we actually started paying rent then. And I remember like going there, and it was 3,000 square feet for $4,200 a month. I mean, it was beautiful, bro.
And you go there now because what was that? That's Ludlow?
Yeah, Ludlow.
Yeah.
And the only reason people came down there was for Katz's Deli.
Yeah.
And maybe Motor City, which was a very iconic
Max
bar.
Max Fish was and still
Max
there.
Fish, yeah, yeah. Mac, and Max Fish. But it was only a place for kind of like the old New York kind of art cool scene. Mm-hmm. And then it ended up sort of exploding to what it is now.
Yeah. What kind of food did you cook? What were your favorite dishes that you ate there?
Well, you know, that was a dish. That was the day that I remember the food I was doing was inspired by my training. But it was just, I wanted to do food that I can just reach people. You know what I mean? And I made empanadas and with chicken picadillo and a smoked tomato salsa, and I made sopes, you know, with black beans and tomatillo avocado salsa, and I made arepas with, you know, braised duck legs and just food that was inspired and fun. And we were so busy. You remember how busy that damn restaurant
yeah.
was. I mean, we would get packed, and there was no reservations. For the first 4 years, we took cash. So it was like one of those things. Like, if you tell people about that now, they're yeah. like, dude, really? Yeah. You did that? I was like, yeah, man. And we just cooked. And we just cooked and had fun. And I remember we had this little window. You remember the restaurant? And when we first opened, we were so busy, I didn't have a lot of staff. But I had a couple guys from Puebla, you know, when I know you're working on a documentary, or it's yeah. almost done now, of Mexican cooks in New York. But I had these guys, and people would walk in and say hello to me. And they're like, oh, you're cooking by yourself, man? I was like, no, dude, I have my helpers. They're just down here. They're little. You can't see them.
Yeah.
They would hand the food up like this above their shoulders.
I mean, it was such an amazing place because not only did it kind of project everything that you wanted to, you know, tell other people about your past, about, you know, your history, your culture. But again, you were just having fun there.
Yeah.
What happens when you're not having fun in a restaurant?
I mean, it's the beginning to the end. It was funny. Last night, I had I was in Harlem with Theo. We went and had a couple drinks at Red Rooster with my dear best friend, Marcus Samuelson. And then I didn't realize that it turns into a party on Monday nights at the Rooster. So if you ever go there, have a chance. It's really awesome. They have live music. And it reminded me a lot of Paladar on Fridays and Saturdays when I used to have live music and DJs and stuff. And that was a long time ago, and people were dancing and drinking and having a ball. And last night, it really reminded me of that.
Yeah.
It reminded me of how much fun you can have in a restaurant. And then, you know, and forget about, you know, like monitoring your staff and all that. And it takes a lot to let go, you know, as an owner and as a chef, when your name's on something. And I just, you got it. I really implore young chefs to do that and stop being so serious about everything. I mean, we're in Roberto's. This is a fun restaurant. This is a fun place where we're at right now. And when you stop having fun, it's not good.
See, what I see in you is that same twinkle that I saw behind the bar at Paladar mm-hmm. when you're on Chopped, when you're on television. But you get to be an authority and spread the gospel in the same way that you shared your food.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, television is such a... it's so impactful, man. It's so... It's really hard to describe. Somebody in Sioux Falls, Iowa now knows how to work with chipotle peppers, and they can go to their local supermarket and make one of my recipes, because Food Network has transported them to a place and given them instant information and access to me. And television is a very, very powerful tool in that way. It exposes you. If you're a douche, you're going to be exposed.
Yeah.
If you're genuine, you will be revered and loved. And that's what I've been doing, and I've tried to do on television. And I didn't do it for any self-promotion. I did it to get people in my restaurant, to be honest. I used it as a marketing tool initially, and then now it's become something different.
Yeah, I mean, one of your latest shows, Taco Trip, mm-hmm. kind of combines both of those things, because you get to be in other people's kitchens. You get to go to, you know, other places that are serving the food that you love, and be able to, you know, disseminate that to, you know, the larger viewing community.
Yeah, and what I love about it is that this new show on Cooking Channel comes on at 9 p.m. by the way, anyway. I think on what, Fridays or Tuesdays, Danielle? Tuesdays. And we're doing a new season, so it'll be out very shortly. But it's cool, because it's very little about me, to be honest. It's kind of like what you're doing right now with me. It's about the people that are cooking the tacos, making these iconic Mexican dishes. And I'm just taking the viewer through them and kind of guiding them around this beautiful journey that we're on. And it's fun. Like, I'm going in a couple of weeks to Portland, Maine. Do people think Portland, Maine has great tacos? Probably not the first thing that registers, you know what I mean? But we're going to find it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, who's making tacos now? Because it's not just Mexicans and Latin chefs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you were in Chicago recently with Paul Kahan.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the idea of everybody embracing the taco and how it's the people's food, and you know, and it's really become a perfect vehicle for so many different kinds of cultures and flavors and things that people dig, you know what I mean? And so I'm going all over. This particular run, I'm doing 10 different cities, and I've been to some really cool places and eaten very interesting interpretations of tacos, and I love it. I don't want people to watch my show and think that they're going to, you know, see classic stuff all the time, because that would be very monotonous and sort of expected.
Yeah.
I want people to be surprised.
So what have been some of those twists that have kind of like...
Yeah, I mean, like I saw one city we were in San Francisco, one of the chefs made a taco with, instead of a tortilla, he used jicama. And that was sort of the shell or tortilla, if you will. And I saw people, we were in Baltimore, and somebody did a soft shell crab taco, you know what I mean, using local Maryland crab. So there's many things like that, you know what I mean? And I cook with John Besh at a restaurant in New Orleans. So, you know what I mean? There's a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, tell me a little bit about that restaurant, because it is the collision of your past and your future, and your friendship. I mean, who knew that you and John Besh were going to be buddies?
Yeah, I mean, we couldn't be any more different, but the idea of having the key to any relationship is having respect, admiration, and love, and that's what I have for him. And I learn from him all the time. Hopefully he learns from me. I guide the food. He kind of runs the restaurant. You know what I'm saying? So the food is completely inspired by Mexico. It's not a Louisiana Creole restaurant. It's a straight up Mexican restaurant. That's what we're doing. Taco centric, tostadas, shared dishes, fun bar program in the CBD in New Orleans on Poydras, and then we have another one in Baltimore as well. And they're just a fun restaurant. And it's funny because two chefs that have big, you know, big egos and past and careers, why come together? And people ask me that all the time. I say, because we can and we want to. Why not pull your resources? You know what I mean? Chefs are very egotistical or very insecure. And we're neither.
You know, it's changed. Like you said, there was no Food Network when you were growing up. There wasn't that bigger, you know, community. You couldn't kind of associate yourself or talk to somebody else in the same way. Now you're constantly on Twitter, on Facebook. I mean, you're interacting. So why not be open and friendly and happy and excited by, you know, this kind of new landscape of food?
Absolutely. And now you have kids that for other reasons would have done something different. Now they're going to culinary school instead of college, probably much to the dismay of their parents. But don't blame me. You know, this is it's fun, it's glamorous, but I hope people get into this business for the right reasons. You have to work your ass off. You make a lot of sacrifices. That does not change. And I think the bar has been raised higher now because of all the attention that this industry has gotten. Like, now we're looking at people to really kick ass and really be focused and really have a point of view with food. And At least what we do in our restaurants, we try to make sure that everyone we bring has a good attitude. And we do, you know, Chef Moves, you know, John and I work with a foundation to help young inner city kids from New Orleans find a future in culinary arts, and it's called Chef's Move.
I mean, you do stuff for Why Hunger. Yeah. I mean, you're supporting the community in a way that you also probably didn't know was possible before.
Yeah. And the idea, and I'll put it to you very simple, you know, as a Mexican American, the idea of Latinos or Latins having role models, there shouldn't be a rapper, shouldn't be an athlete. Food. You know, I can't dunk a ball like Kobe Bryant. I can't sing like, you know, Pitbull or whatever, but you can make my chicken recipe.
Yeah.
So that's important. You know what I mean? And we want to try to be an example for young Latins going into kitchens and just in general. You know what I mean? And I think we're very privileged to do that, to be a mentor. You know, the word chef really, in essence, means teacher.
I know you can sing.
I've dabbled in mariachi music. My tío's looking at me like, yeah, right. But it really depends on how much everyone has drank.
Yeah.
Or drank, I should say. And then that sort of kind of determines how good I sing.
I mean, if we had auto-tone, maybe I'd let you do it right now. But we'll let you record an album and I'll play it sometime.
Yeah.
So seeing you, there is something very obvious.
Mm-hmm.
And it is these tattoos. Mm-hmm. And I know for years we've worked together and we've worked on different projects, shoots, and every once in a while those tattoos were asked to be covered.
Mm.
What do they mean to you, and why are they
sleeveless? It's funny because, like, you know, now it's so cliche if you're a young cook to have tattoos, and it kind of, you know, if I see another kid with a pig tattoo, I'm going to puke in my mouth. You know what I mean? It's like, does that make you cook better because you have a pig tattoo? I mean, or some beets running up your arm? Like, you know, come on. But I did initially because I've always gone against the grain. I hated authority. I wanted to be different. And you know, and that's important. So I'm doing right now, I'm part owner in a tattoo shop called Daredevil in the Lower East Side, where we have a tattoo museum, the only one in New York connected to the shop. My good friend Michelle Miles had Daredevil across the street from Paladar, and that's how initially we became buddies. And we're actually doing a Kickstarter campaign right now for Daredevil. So for all you guys that want to contribute to Daredevil and all the love that we're doing there, please visit the website, Kickstarter. I don't even know how to get there, but you guys are smart, and you'll figure it out.
Yeah, and maybe they'll even give you a pig tattoo if you really mean it. If you promise to cook really great food and try as hard as you can in this industry.
It's funny, like if somebody were to donate $100,000 to my charity of choice, and I would get a pig tattoo.
Okay.
I'm just throwing that out
there. Yeah,
I would, just for cliche's sake.
Yeah, like you already don't have one hidden on there somewhere.
I don't, actually. I have a wild boar, I think, getting stabbed with a knife, but not a pig.
Yeah. You've done books. You've done television. You've done restaurants. Is there something else that you haven't done that you want to kind of forge into next?
It's funny. I just met with my manager and my partner, Andrew, yesterday, and we talked about this very thing. We really want to open, we want to do a festival of Latin, celebrating Latin cuisine. Definitely something that we want to do. We want to definitely sort of get more into the philanthropy thing. And I really very, very, very committed to helping restaurant kitchen workers, especially recent immigrants, get the sort of rights and opportunities that they deserve. So I'm really trying to focus on that in the next couple of years. And then I'm going to do another book.
Yeah.
Which you will be shooting the photographs for. So
I said, I'm a very busy person though.
Yes. Well, try to fit me in.
Yeah.
Jesus, Michael.
Excellent. And one more time, please roll those R's for me.
Arrón y paladar.
Thank you so much for being on, buddy.
Thank you, buddy. I'll see you soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
He lives in my neighborhood.
Yeah, we're bros now. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.